And we can become either discouraged, or at times we can simply plunge ahead recklessly without really thinking about how we're acting and what we're doing. You've all heard another saying, fools rush in where angels fear to tread. So the virtue of fortitude, or courage, or bravery, as we often also call, gives us the strength of will to overcome difficulties that we encounter throughout the course of our moral lives. If you take a look at paragraph 1808 of the Catechism of the Catholic Church, you're going to read there, fortitude is the moral virtue that ensures firmness in difficulties and constancy in pursuit of the good. It strengthens the resolve to resist temptations and to overcome obstacles in the moral life. Paragraph 1808. So as you can see, what the Catechism is describing when it describes the virtue of fortitude is not just one individual brave or courageous act that we might perform at any given moment. We know, for example, that people under tremendous pressure can lift a car off of someone else who's crushed under it. If you really had to, if you're running away from the chainsaw-wielding assailant, you could probably run a mile in under 4 minutes. You'd be praying all along as you did. Fortitude means, as the Catechism says, that idea of firmness and constancy. I'm not just performing a brave or courageous act one time, but I can do it over and over again. I can habitually face up to challenges and meet them and overcome them. The very word fortitude itself comes from a Latin word meaning strength. And so fortitude is a virtue that gives us inner strength. Strength to face up to challenges and trials, to the crosses that appear in our lives that we carry, but also the strength to know our own limits and not to just plunge ahead recklessly in a foolhardy way. At times, fortitude or courage is the virtue that allows us to overcome fears. And at other times in our lives, if we live and practice the virtue of fortitude, then it holds us back. It restrains us from overconfidence, excessive boldness, especially in the moral or spiritual life, especially where, for example, temptations might be concerned. Might think, I can overcome the temptations that I'm facing. Pretty soon we find out, if we're not given that virtue of fortitude, if we haven't really acquired it, we fall flat on our faces. Since all the acquired virtues, and in their own way, even the theological virtues, as we'll see starting next week, since all the acquired virtues in particular deal with a mean between two extremes, that is, a virtuous middle position, a middle path, a middle way between too much of something and too little of something. Since all the virtues deal with that mean between two extremes, the virtue of fortitude strengthens us to avoid giving in to the kind of excessive fear that paralyzes us from action. Acting, as well as to avoid being overconfident in the face of danger or challenge or some trial. Let me give you an example of the latter. All of us, I think, are familiar with being afraid to act or to move forward, but sometimes it's a little harder to see where we might be overconfident. When I was studying at the North American College over in Rome. I was in my third year, and about 2 years behind me, I believe it was another seminarian whom I got to know, and his name was Frank. He came from Boston. And one Christmas vacation, Frank and a couple of his classmates decided to spend Christmas vacation in Austria. So they went to Vienna, they went to Innsbruck, to Salzburg, toured around, and so on. They had rented a car, so they were driving. When the time came for Frank and his two classmates to come back to Italy, they reached the border between Austria and Italy. And the border guards, as normally happened, asked for their passports. Now, usually, passport control didn't take very long, especially if you held a U.S. passport, which all these guys did, and it was, by and large, something pretty easy, even perfunctory. The guards just kind of checked and stamped, and here you go, and it took you no more than a few minutes. Well, in this particular instance, Frank and his friends could see the guard who had their passport go into the booth and get on the telephone. And instead of 5 minutes, it was taking 15, 20, approaching half an hour. Now, there were two guards. One was on the phone holding these guys' passports. The other had the machine gun pointed at the car that Frank and his friends were in. Naturally, Frank and classmates were a little curious by this time, getting more and more nervous, wondering what could possibly be the problem. So Frank leans over to his friends. He says, "Guys, there's three of us, one of him. I think we can take him." That's not fortitude, nor is it prudence. Okay, I think we can take him. Yes, he's got the machine gun, and you're going to jump him. That's being foolhardy. That's being reckless. The virtue of fortitude prevents us from doing just that. Okay? But obviously, as we said a couple of weeks ago, you need prudence to recognize when to act, when not to act, when to stand up to dangers, and when to know the safest course might be to take a step back, to wait, to be patient, not to rush in. Almost anything that entails difficulty actually requires the virtue of fortitude. We can easily think of those who serve in our armed forces, our military, who certainly need this particular virtue in order to face the sacrifices, the hardships, the trials that are associated with military life, and above all, to face up to the possibility they might have to put their own lives on the line, that they might have to face injury or death in battle. That's an easy picture when we think of the virtue of fortitude. But it also takes fortitude for a student to study and write a paper when the rest of his or her friends are out enjoying themselves at a party. It takes fortitude to sit there and sacrifice the good time for the sake of something better. If I want my degree, if I want to pass these exams, I have to study, I've got to write the paper. So the virtue of fortitude helps us to stick to those kinds of activities and set aside, if only for the moment, the party, the good time, the thought of slacking off in our homework. A politician, for example, may fail to vote according to his or her principles out of fear of losing popularity, or maybe losing an election. It takes fortitude to stand up for and defend, especially publicly, what's right and good, what's true and morally just. Somebody may find it hard to visit the sick for fear of becoming infected, catching some communicable disease. A person may refrain from evangelizing a coworker out of fear of how he will be regarded, or out of fear of not being able to answer every question or every objection. Maria here, as you know, is the DRE. I'm sure people she asks and says, "You'd be a great catechist," have said, "Oh, I'm too afraid, I can't do that. I wouldn't know how to answer any questions the kids ask." We need the virtue of fortitude in these situations. Most of us will need fortitude to say no to others when no is the right answer, when no is the right thing to say. Why? Because most of us want to be liked. How many parents, for instance, might not say no to their children because they fear that their children will not like them and will say bad things about them and post a nasty little note on Facebook or text their friend, "You won't believe what mom and dad said to me today." People fail to be honest out of fear. Think of St. Peter, who three times, as we know, denied even knowing the Lord, let alone being associated with him. If you take a look at the Gospel of John, chapter 18, verses 15 to 27, that's where that scene is reported. Peter is asked, "Now you must know him, you're a Galilean." And he begins to curse and swear, "I do not even know the man." Why? Peter lied out of fear that he too might be arrested. So Peter fails in that instance to be both courageous, he fails in fortitude, but he also failed in justice, because by lying to others and most of all, he denied the love and devotion that he owed to Jesus. So courage is needed in so many different situations that you and I can encounter on a daily basis. Courage is needed to be faithful, both to oneself and to others. At the same time, though, we know that there is a false kind of courage that really isn't courage at all, but recklessness, daring, foolhardiness. Some of the moral texts that speak of the virtue of fortitude use these terms. False courage occur in at least five different situations or circumstances. First, a person could be ignorant of the danger that's involved. Sure, my car is designed to go 100 miles an hour. I'm going to test it out on this twisty, windy road. There won't be any cliffs up there. There won't be any slick spots that will, you know, slide me right over the edge. Okay? We might be ignorant danger at all. Secondly, we might be too optimistic about the nature of the danger. I'll walk down this dark alley late at night by myself, because after all, I've taken one lesson in karate. Don't mess with me. We just don't know the danger that's involved. I'm too optimistic about it. Or, thirdly, we could be overly confident concerning our own abilities. We might think of ourselves as strong persons, persons of real character, persons of real virtue. So it doesn't matter if I put myself in a situation where there's temptation to sin, I can handle it. And for most of us, reality is, we end up, again, falling flat on our faces. there's a false courage that comes when we act only or mostly on one's own emotions, especially when we act out of anger, or sometimes even out of depression. We can be depressed and choose to do something, and we have that kind of daring, that recklessness, that false courage that leads us to do something that ordinarily we would never do. And finally, we can be overly motivated by seeking a reward. Okay. Sure, the lotto is $32 million. I'll go sell everything and buy up as many lottery tickets as I can find because I know I'm going to win it. In those kinds of instances, people can, in fact, perform brave or courageous actions, but they don't possess virtue of fortitude. You can do something brave, you can do something courageous, but it doesn't necessarily make you a person who lives and exercises the virtue of fortitude, because again, fortitude, as the Catechism reminds us, it gives us that constancy in doing what's good, striving to overcome challenges and evils and face up to them, not just once, but again and again and again on a regular basis. So possessing and practicing the virtue of fortitude really empowers us, and it gives us not only internal strength, strength of mind and will, it also gives us self-control, which leads into the virtue of temperance, which we're going to talk about in a few minutes. Take a look at St. Paul's second letter to Timothy, chapter 1, verse 7, where St. Paul links the two virtues of fortitude and temperance, and this is what he says. In 2 Timothy chapter 1, verse 7, St. Paul says, "For God did not give us a spirit of cowardice, but rather of power," that is fortitude, "rather of power and love and self-control." So the person who's truly brave, who's truly courageous, who truly has acquired the virtue of fortitude, is able also to exercise self-control in any given situation. But more than that, as we all know, courage inspires us to do great things, to be true leaders, not simply in society at large, but to be a true leader in one's family. Be a true leader, certainly in civic or social life, to be a true leader in the parish, your pastor. Mother DeSalle mentions a need from the pulpit. You have the virtue of fortitude, it may lead you to step up and say, "I'll help. I'll take on this project. I'll talk to my friends, my fellow parishioners. We'll get this done." All of that stems from living the virtue of fortitude. At the same time, fortitude can make us strong enough to admit our faults, to take ownership of our shortcomings and sins, and not simply to play the blame game, "Well, it was this other individual's fault." Think about the story of original sin, the third chapter of Genesis. What do we see going on? We see Eve blaming the serpent after Adam has blamed Eve. Adam had lost that gift, that virtue of fortitude. He wasn't going to go before God and own up to the fact, "Hey, I did what you told me not to do. I ate of the fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and evil. I'm at fault." Adam's reaction is, "Well, it's her fault. Woman you gave me," notice how he puts it, He tries even to put the blame on God. Well, you know, it can't be my fault because you gave me this woman who then tempted me. So God turns to Eve. Well, why did you do this? Well, it's not me, it's that serpent you made. There's a fortitude. Right? The fortitude enables us to be, on the other hand, humble and forthright enough to go to the confession, which can be hard, it can be difficult, but we go there strengthened by the virtue of fortitude and lay bare our souls before God, confessing what we have done and what we have failed to do, and making that firm resolution to amend our lives with the help of God's grace. And the motive for that act of fortitude, of course, is the whole story of God's merciful love for us sinners that has been recorded in the Old Testament and the New. And that story of his love, his mercy that he has shown us, is accompanied by his promise to be with us all. Take a look at the book of Joshua. In Joshua chapter 1, verse 9, we read there, God speaking to Joshua, "Have I not commanded you? Be strong and of good courage. Be not frightened, neither be dismayed. For the Lord your God is with you wherever you go." What a great verse to hold on to, right, in our moments when we face challenge, when we need that influence of the virtue of fortitude. Be strong, be of good courage, be not frightened, nor be dismayed. We can practice the virtue of fortitude because we know God himself is with us. As he says in the end of St. Matthew's Gospel, Matthew chapter 28, verse 20, "Behold, I am with you always, even until the end of the age." So this motive of the story of God's merciful love for us sinners and his promise to be always with us enables us, if need be, to be courageous throughout our lives, even to the end. Fortitude gives us the habitual willingness to be ready to lay down our lives, to die, if need be, for the sake of what is right, for the sake of Christ, for the sake of the gospel. That's why Christian theologians recognize that fortitude belongs, in a preeminent way, to the martyrs of the church. Martyrs are living, if we could say that, living examples of the virtue of fortitude. And as you may know, martyr, the word martyr, comes from the Greek, and it means a witness. So the martyr witnesses to something and someone and shows forth his or her willingness to overcome persecution, and even death itself. And as we know, throughout the history of the church, there have been powerful witnesses, courage that martyrs over the centuries have given. And we don't have to go back to the first or second century. There are martyrs even today. Think of the 21 Syrian Christians who were beheaded by ISIS, and they died confessing the name of Jesus. One of those, in fact, was not a Christian, was not a Coptic Christian, and yet he was so inspired by the example of the others that he said, "Your God is my God." And for that, he was put to death. The Coptic patriarch, who was actually called Pope in the Coptic Church, the leader of the Coptic Church, declared that these 21 Syrians were actually martyrs. So it's very interesting. We find even today the example of those who live out the virtue of fortitude, which enabled them to bear witness to Christ even to the end. There's a transforming power of the virtue of fortitude that can be shown in our lives. And this virtue, because it transforms us, because it strengthens us, it helps us to stick to our lifelong pilgrimage without giving up, without trying to cut corners, without settling for just the easy way. Now, as disciples of Christ, you and I are called to embrace our crosses. As Jesus himself tells us in the gospel, you must take up your cross each day, follow in my footsteps. That doesn't mean we have to go looking for crosses. As many of the saints have said, don't go looking. There are going to be enough that come without our looking for them. But when those crosses do come in our lives, how do we carry them? By seeking to practice and acquire and live and exercise the virtue of fortitude. So that when the going gets tough, you and I can persevere. Now, when the going gets tough, the tough go shopping, as my friend had said. So we've kind of looked briefly at the first part of my friend's words, when the going gets tough. The second part, though, the tough go shopping, might lead us, does lead us, to an examination of the virtue of temperance. As we said at the beginning, both fortitude and temperance have to do with personal self-discipline. So probably most of us, when we do go shopping, generally we know what we're shopping for. We usually stick to our list, if it's groceries or household items, things like that. If we go shopping for a new suit or a pair of shoes, generally we know what we need, we know what we want, and we usually stick to that list. But I think we're all familiar with the way that stores will place certain items near the cash registers in order to manipulate us into buying something that wasn't on our list, something that we know that we really don't need, but our desire exceeds our reason. Stores, advertising agencies, and so forth, call it impulse buying. Probably all given in at one time or another and picked up something merely on an impulse. We're attracted to something, something that looks good, something that's desirable, and we say to ourselves, I want that. I've got to have it. And we can often end up being intemperate, immoderate. The virtue of temperance, as the Catechism of the Catholic Church tells us in paragraph 1809, moderates the attraction of pleasures and provides balance in the use of created goods. It ensures the will's mastery over instincts and keeps desires within the limits of what is honorable. From our own experience, you and I know that as a result of original sin, our human nature is weakened, it has been wounded. And one of the effects of original sin is what theologians call concupiscence, which refers to how our passions and our desires are not completely or easily subject to right reason or prudence, which is really right reason and action. This doesn't mean we cannot control ourselves at all, or that we deny our desires altogether. It just means that to attain control of our desires, to master ourselves, to gain self-control, is not always easy. Concupiscence is what leads us to say to ourselves, maybe even to others, that if one Krispy Kreme donut tastes delicious, the whole dozen must taste better, and so we ingest a dozen Krispy Kremes in one sitting. And we might pay price for that a little later on. What we're called to do, each one of us, is to acquire virtue, aided by the grace of Christ, if we are to become the persons we ought to be. That is, if we are to fulfill our potential as children of God. Let me give you an interesting example that I ran across several weeks ago. I happened to see a portion of an interview with a man named Theodore Dalrymple. I suspect he's British because the whole context of his remarks was Great Britain and life in modern-day Great Britain. Dalrymple is a self-described atheist. But in the course of this particular interview, Dalrymple said this: about half of British homes no longer have a dining table. People do not eat meals together. They graze, finding what they want in the fridge and eating in a solitary fashion whenever they feel like it, which is usually often, irrespective of the other people in the household. This means they never learn to discipline their conduct. They never learn the state of their appetite at any given moment should not be the sole consideration in deciding whether to eat or not. In other words, one's own interior state is all important in deciding when to eat. And this, Dalrymple said, is the model of all their behavior. You can easily see how people who attach such importance to their own desires and lack any other criteria to help them decide to behave come to do evil. Now, what Dalrymple was describing was simply what we would call intemperance, or a lack of moderation. When we speak of the virtue of temperance, we can connect it with moderation, just as fortitude can be alternately termed courage or bravery. So temperance has to do with moderation. The virtue of temperance enables us habitually or to moderate our desire for pleasure, especially in regard to food or drink or sexuality. But in a broad sense, as the Catechism points out, pleasure that comes from any real created good. So we're not denying the goodness of created things, but when created goods, whatever they may be, when these created goods are inordinately pursued, that is, when they are pursued beyond right reason, prudence again, right, then they can be harmful to us, both physically and spiritually. We know, for example, the health problems that can result from overindulgence in food or drink, even sexual passion, but overindulgence in earthly pleasures has a spiritual effect as well, one that's perhaps even more insidious, because overindulgence in created goods turns our hearts from the things of God. And as a result, our attachment temporal things increases while our desire for God tends to decrease. So Jesus speaks of seed cast among the thorns in one of his parables as being those who hear the word of God, but the cares of the world and the delight in riches and the desire for other things enter in and choke the word, and it proves unfruitful. It's the parable of the sower who goes out to sow. Take a look at Mark chapter 4. That's where you'll find the parable. Elsewhere in the gospel, Jesus reminds us that where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. Matthew chapter 6, verse 21. So we can fall into the trap of pursuing created goods, the good things of the world, in an immoderate way. Overindulge in them. That's probably the bigger vice, the bigger sin than underindulgence. Although, as we know, there are those who do not eat enough. We see people who get physically sick, as well as psychologically, spiritually, through things like anorexia, bulimia, which also have that psychological and spiritual component to them, as well as the physical problems. The virtue of temperance, again, helps us chart that middle path. Not too much, not too little, just enough. The basis of the Lord's words about the seed that gets choked off by the cares of this world, on the basis of the Lord's words about where your treasure is, there your heart will be also, the church's moral tradition has seen the need for other virtues in our lives that are allied to, or subsets, if you will, of temperance. Virtues that enable us to keep our heart centered on the right path and not stray off into the vices or the sins of excess or defect. So, the general virtue of temperance, for instance, includes other virtues such as chastity, continence, modesty in regard to matters relating to our sexuality, abstinence and sobriety in regard to matters relating to food and drink, clemency and meekness in regard to moderating our anger, and also the virtue of humility, which permits us to recognize that God, and not simply ourselves, but God is the true source of all that is good or excellent within us. I never knew my father's father, my paternal grandfather, because he died before I was born, but my father would tell stories about him. And one of the stories would take place as the family was sitting at the dinner table. My father was the last of seven children, so all of them would be gathered at the dinner table. And his father, my grandfather, whom I never knew, always dressed for dinner. Suit and tie. Wool in the winter, seersucker in the summer. Now, you don't have to follow that example, but he would, as the kids were sort of jostling for the whatever was left in the on the plate or on the, you know, dish what my grandmother had made, my grandfather would watch this, and he would raise his arm as if he was pointing to an inscription. And he would say, "Moderation in all things," preaching the virtue of temperance. And he lived it from what my father would tell me about it. Seemed to be a very, very temperate man. So in order for us, then, to be temperate persons, you and I have to practice ways of moderating our desire for or attraction to things that give us pleasure. It's not wrong, it's not sinful, to enjoy a fine meal. I would much rather have a nice steak than, you know, a tough piece of chicken that's been pretty much cooked to the consistency of shoe leather. It's not wrong to enjoy a nice glass of wine rather than something that comes from a box. The key is moderation. If you eat a filet mignon every night, what could happen? Not only health problems, but we begin to kind of be taken over by things. We might need a computer. Probably most of us have a desktop, a laptop, maybe an iPad, something at home that is very valuable, that's helpful. We can do an awful lot of work for whatever our profession may be, or it might keep track of our household budget. We can email friends, we can post the latest news on Facebook. We can do many things. But if we're constantly trading in our computer, which works perfectly fine, perfectly well for our needs, for the latest upgrade because it has just one extra megabyte of memory, are we being tempted? It's a question to ask. Granted, there are certain professions that need the latest and fastest in order to do their work. But for most of us, if we use computers at home for simple household things, kind of common everyday sort of uses, are we intemperate in always trying constantly to get the latest and greatest and the most expensive model on the market? Maybe. Maybe not, but it's something to think about, something to reflect upon. So we need to practice practical ways of moderating the attraction that we feel for the good things of this world. So to help us cultivate the virtue of temperance, the church steps in. One example is what you and I are experiencing in these days of Lent. The church reminds us that there are days of fast and abstinence. More generally, the church reminds us not to place ourselves deliberately in the occasions of sin. And the church calls us to be vigilant in our lives so as to hopefully ease the hold that some particular temptations can have over us. So if we are tempted to overeat or to be gluttonous, then prudence, right reason, coupled with temperance, would suggest that we maybe not dine at the all-you-can-eat buffet every night of the week, okay? So that we can moderate, be temperate in our food intake. If we're tempted to drink too much, probably bartending would not be the right career path. If we find that we're giving in to a variety of sexual temptations in our lives, then we need to be vigilant about and moderate our use of things like the internet or television. We need to look at our entertainment choices, how we use the media, and maybe we might even have to pray for the gift of a virtue of fortitude to get rid of such occasions of sin entirely. As Jesus tells us in the Gospel, if your eye is your problem, pluck it out. If your foot leads you into trouble, cut it off. If your hand gives you problems and leads you to sin, cut it off. I don't think our Lord wanted us to live through life blind and staggering around, but he's calling us to a radical examination, largely based on virtues such as fortitude, temperance, always kind of allied with prudence, to say, where are the temptations in my life? Where are the moral problems that I might be having? What am I doing about them? when we identify it, then we have to ask the Lord to strengthen our wills, to give us that virtue of fortitude to act upon it, to say, okay, it might be hard, but you know what? I've just got to pull the plug on the TV. I'm going to give it away. If that's the problem, and if that's what it takes, that's what we're called to do. So these two virtues of fortitude and temperance then can work together in our lives to help us stick to the path that leads ultimately to God. We need fortitude to face up to the challenges, the trials, the difficulties, the dangers on our journey. And we need temperance to moderate our desires and the way that we make use of the good things of God's creation. So together, both of these moral virtues, fortitude and temperance, together they remind us that the fulfillment of the Christian life remains always a conformity to Christ that will be progressively achieved through a life of self-emptying. So let me stop here, and if there are any questions that you might have, I'll try to answer them as best as I can.
Yes. Well, you just said something that I thought, self-emptying. How do you define that? You mean that's the opposite, that's denying?
It may involve self-denial. But self-emptying love means that the first question that I'm called to ask is not what's in it for me, but rather how can I give? How can I go out of myself? Okay. And as we know, that's not easy. But isn't that exactly what Jesus displays on the cross? So the cross becomes the model for our Christian life. Can I go out of myself? Can I give of myself before taking from another?
On that same thing, you know, the spiritual work of mercy, of bearing wrongs patiently. So could you explain that between, I mean, how are we supposed to take that versus, like, justice?
Okay. That's a good question, you know. For those who may not have heard, it was one of the spiritual works of mercy is to bear wrongs patiently. So there are going to be moments in our lives where we do suffer injustices. Someone else gets the promotion at work. And maybe we, you know, in every respect, we deserve it more, but guess what? Your coworker got the promotion because he's the boss's nephew. Or the boss's daughter. Sometimes there are going to be injustices that we may or may not be able to do anything about. So bearing wrongs patiently, which involves the virtue of fortitude, gives us the strength to accept that injustice. We recognize it's wrong, it's an injustice, but I will accept it as, this is kind of the cross the Lord has asked me to carry now in my life at this moment. Okay. And again, it's all based on the model Christ himself gave. His trial, arrest, his sentence of death, that was all unjust. He wore it out of love. And out of that comes a greater good, because bearing wrongs patiently, as the spiritual work of mercy says, is really aimed at helping us come to recognize that we are being perfected when we bear those wrongs, those injustices, with patience, not lashing out, not becoming resentful or bitter or getting, you know, so wrapped up in ourselves that our lives become poisoned, as it were. We bear them patiently, even though they're wrong, even though it's an injustice, it helps us not to fall into that kind of spiritual resentment that can stunt our spiritual growth. So that helps.
Let's take the temperance movement in the United States. Perhaps a misnomer. But there were both adherents and detractors on both sides. And there was a radical position against the use of alcohol. Both sides demonstrated fortitude in their courageous search for the moral right. How can you have both sides demonstrating a virtue and yet be on exact opposite, polar opposites in their positions?
Because of human nature and its weaknesses, the temperance movement, one of the things that we can sometimes confuse is the idea of personal virtue versus a social or political program to try to impose it. You know, St. Thomas Aquinas, back in the Middle Ages, talked about the fact that the state not only can't, but really ought not, to prohibit every kind of vice, because then it makes society unlivable. So, temperance movement probably had a noble aim to help people. It was more than just moderate their use of alcohol, it was eliminate it entirely. But that really becomes a matter of one's growth in personal virtue, as opposed to something that ought to be imposed. Even the Catechism recognizes that a moderate use of alcohol is not sinful, but that's the key, it's moderate. So sometimes people can defend a position like total abstinence, total temperance, and have the fortitude to stand up for what they truly believe in. Whereas other people can take the opposite side and again have the fortitude to stand up for what they truly believe in. And that's not necessarily being contradictory about it. It's just that, okay, for you, that's your position and you have the courage to defend it and promote it and so forth and try to get other people to agree with you. And if I take the opposite, okay, then I have the courage to say what my position is. And in the long run, that does promote a healthier society because people are able to debate the issues and so forth. But what's always needed, as with all the virtues we've been looking at, is prudence. So what's the right course of action to take in this instance? Is it in harmony, in accord with right reason for the imposition of complete abstinence throughout all levels of society? Probably not. And that's why the temperance movement really, there are a lot of factors, but I mean, underlying it, people recognized, hey, that ought to be my choice, not somebody else telling me what to do. So you can be firm and strong and possessed of one virtue, but maybe not another. Okay. But prudence is the one that's needed to decide and to recognize, okay, here I'm going too far, or maybe here I'm not going far enough. So they all kind of work together. But you can have one virtue and not another. That can happen.
Hi, Father. What was the problem with passport control at the Austrian border?
Oh, back to the story of my friend Frank. What happened? Well, the fact that I'm telling his story means that he didn't take the guy down. He told me later, because I asked him that, like, well, what was the problem? He said, apparently there was a car that looked almost exactly like the one they had rented, same color, same make and model, that had been involved in some robbery. And so they were stopping all the cars and checking it out. And when they saw, Americans, they thought, maybe there's something here. So it's something like that. So he survived. Frank, Frank was also, in addition to, at least at that moment, lacking in fortitude, he was not, shall we say, the most prudent of individuals either, because he told me this himself. So he said, I have a fascination for buttons. I have to push it and find out what it does. Which, you know, in your own home may work, but, you know, in the you know, console at NORAD, you know. So he's touring through the Schönbrunn Palace in Vienna, where the Habsburg Emperor used to live. And they go through the grand ballroom there, and the guide is pointing out this and this and the history and so forth. So Frank sees this switch on the wall, button. I wonder what this does. He turns out the whole lights. I said, you turned out the lights in the palace? He says, yeah. And we got out of there as quickly as we could. So, in two instances, he lacked virtuous behavior, fortitude and prudence. You know, I don't know whatever happened, because I was ordained and came back home, and I don't know that he was ever ordained. I'd have to look it up. Either that or a border guard. Enough to come back next week, we'll talk about faith and hope. We'll look at the theological virtues and then finish with charity, which is a good way to end. Okay. So, in the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit,
amen.
Glory be to the Father, and to the Son, and to the Holy Spirit.
As